Today's Teisho will be on case 87 in the P.N. Lu, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 87 is entitled Umon's Medicine and Sickness Cure Each Other. Engo's introduction. The clear-eyed person knows no restriction. At one time, he stands on the top of the mountain with the weeds thick around him. At another time, he is in the bustle of the marketplace, enjoying perfect ease of mind. When he displays the wrath of Nada, he is three-faced and six-armed. When he shows the mercy of the sun-faced and the moon-faced Buddha, he gives forth the all-embracing light of blessing. In every particle, he reveals all the bodies of the Buddha. Mixing with people, he trudges through the mire. When he performs a transcendent action, even Buddhas cannot follow him, and they are driven back thousands of miles. Is there anyone among you who can go with him and act with him? See the following. Main subject. Umon said to his disciples, medicine and sickness cure each other. All this earth is your medicine. Where do you find yourself? Secho's verse, all the earth is medicine. Ancient and modern, men make a great mistake. Shut the gate, but do not build the cart. The universe is the highway, vast and wide. Mistaken, all mistaken. Though their noses are stuck up to heaven, they will still be pierced for a rope. So, this is beautiful summer day in a beautiful place, and everybody is practicing wholeheartedly. When people come into the Dokusan, it's really wonderful to see people so sincerely practicing. And we've been doing a lot of sitting, a lot of zazen, and many people have even taken advantage of the extra sitting periods. So it's really quite impressive, really deep practice here. And thank you for that. So, the koan is a really important koan. Because when we think about Zen practice, we think about, say, stillness, peacefulness and calm, silence and simplicity. And those are really very valuable, indispensable aspects of what we do. You know, so one of the reasons it's important to have a place like this to do sesshin is that we can, you know, get away from our jobs and our concerns. And even, you know, our families, you know, and come here and just turn off the phone. Hopefully your phone is turned off. And just dedicate yourself to this, what Zen calls this matter, right? The pursuit of awakening. And that's really wonderful. It's impossible to do that without getting away from things, right? I mean, in East Asia and in India, you know, traditionally many temples, or at least many meditation centers, were located outside of the cities. There were definitely monasteries and temples in the cities, but it's usually the case that people need to get out of the hustle and the bustle and go to some place that's secluded and quiet and serene. Now, even the Buddha, when he left home, and set off on his quest for awakening. He became what you could call like a forest-dwelling rishi. He became a wandering mendicant who meditated by day and would go and beg support from pious people. And he lived in, he was always moving around. He had no home. And he liked to go to places, what are called charnel grounds, which are places where bodies were burned. Or we would say graveyards, right? So it sounds a little morbid that the Buddha often meditated in graveyards, but near my house there's a graveyard, and it's a beautiful place, very peaceful, and beautiful trees all over, and many animals. There are hawks and deer live in there. It's like almost like a preserve, like an animal preserve. And it's incredibly nice in there. The Buddha picked places that are quiet and serene and sequestered. This idea of being separated from all the nonsense, right? So if you we sort of emulate the Buddha's example by doing the same thing, coming here. We do sleep on beds, which is nice, and we don't beg for our food, but we're definitely in a serene, quiet place. And in fact, traditional Indian Buddhism, the first jhana, is the state of calm that you enter into when you sequester yourself. So there were thought to be different states of consciousness on the road, on the way to enlightenment, and they're called jhanas, or states of consciousness. And the first jhana is suddenly enjoying the experience of being in a secluded and sequestered place. And indeed, it's wonderful. I mean, people in our culture often go like out to the woods to be in nature in order to be sequestered in this way, and you can be quiet. You can have time to be reflective, or time to slow down and observe. And we don't give ourselves that opportunity at all. So it's very important to preserve a place in your life for that, not only for sesshin, which is the heart of Zen, but also in your daily life. We're all quite busy. It's important to carve out a little time, either in the early morning or later, where you're not looking at the computer, you're not on the phone, you're just going to sit down and focus on the breath, or focus on mu, and be present with that. And you owe it to yourself to do that. People sometimes will say, "I just don't have time to meditate." But people have time to watch TV. People have time to do other things. Nobody goes to work and says, "I didn't wash my face or brush my teeth. I was just too busy." It's part of your self-care. It's part of your ritual. We brush our teeth, we wash our face, we go to the bathroom. And meditation is kind of like taking care of yourself, taking good care of yourself. So making a space in your life for that kind of calm, sequestered, even if it's just in your attic or in your basement, somewhere you can go and sit, or coming to the university. Many people are in situations where there's just no time to sit, and it's never quiet. So coming to the university is a wonderful thing. And if you have, if you are at sesshin and you've been into sesshin before and you've had to, for some reason, go to the store, one of the reasons I don't send other people to the store is after 3 or 4 days of this, when you go into the store, it can be a little jarring, right? You're in this very beautiful, secluded space. Things are slowing down, and you go into the grocery store, and the grocery store is you know, it's easy to forget. It's like a three-ring circus of consumerism, you know? So, you know, they are actually scientists who have tried to figure out how to place products to get your attention. And so when you come in the store, people actually have done there are done complex studies to see how to get you to buy the most. And so they route you through the store so that you'll do, you know, you'll see this first and this second, and maximum, you know, distraction, really. To, you know, you come in, you want to buy three things, eggs, you know, whatever, milk and bread, right? And you come out with a big load of stuff, and half of it you didn't even plan on. Well, that's some social scientist has thought that all through and gotten a big bonus for getting you to do that, you know. So our culture is very distracting, and it causes people a lot of distress, right, and sort of needlessly. We could go on and on about how manipulative our culture is and how it likes keeping people on the edge, you know, on the edge. So, you know, some of it's unintentional, but some of it's not unintentional, you know. So, you know, I am in my early 60s, and I have seen many health crazes come and go, you know. So, you know, pretty much in America, lots of people drink coffee, for example. And you know, there was a time when there was a spate of news stories. Scientists had discovered that coffee was really bad for you. And everybody was so, it's like, oh my God, I've been drinking this for years, you know, am I going to get cancer, blah, blah, blah. You know, people, you know, bought coffee substitutes and decaffeinated coffee, and especially decaffeinated coffee, right? It was the caffeine, you know. It's anyway, you know, 20 years later, coffee is great. You know, drink all the coffee you want. You know, it turns out it's good for your heart. It staves off Alzheimer's disease. It's like, drink up, you know, this is great. And, you know, you wonder, you know, if the Coffee Institute had something to do with all this research. But this is the way we live, right? So it's very important to leave home. You know, the Buddha was the Buddha left his home and never returned. You know, it's interesting that the Buddha, when he left his family, he became a wandering ascetic, and he had his great awakening experience in his early 30s. But he never, you know, he didn't have his daikenshon go home and become king of the Shakya Republic or chieftain of the Shakya Republic. He did not do that. You know, he remained basically a person who was on outside of the regular society for the rest of his life. Now, you know, I have a house, and I have, you know, payments on my house, and I have repair bills and stuff like that. So, you know, I'm what the Buddhists used to call a householder, not a home leaver. I own a house. You know, sometimes I, you know, bitterly regret it, but I do own one. And in ancient Buddhism, you know, there were home leavers, people who left home to seek enlightenment, and householders. But both groups in Buddhism could achieve awakening. And it's very clear that the Buddha intended for both groups to practice Zen. And in South Asian Buddhism, in Sri Lanka, for example, basically when people go have retreats, usually they're like a day-long retreat or a couple days, people actually become like monks and nuns for 2 days. It's like they have like a little vow that they take, and for 2 days they're monks or nuns. And they become home leavers while they're on their retreat. And we don't think of ourselves that way necessarily, as monks and nuns for 7 days. But it's necessary to leave home in order to, you know, pursue awakening. And then we do go home, but even when you're home, it's necessary to leave home for an hour a day or as often as you can during the week. You know, this idea of finding a quiet place that's sequestered, cutting off the world, entering a serene state is absolutely crucial. And, you know, when you come to Sesshin, as you will recall, you know, usually day one of Sesshin, your mind is full of thoughts and you're rehearsing. You know, when I was training in Seattle with Genki Roshi, you know, I would go to Sesshin, and the first day of Sesshin, I would always think to myself, why am I doing this? You know, I've got so much to do. You know, why did I make this decision? And then by around the end of day two, it was like, ah, screw it. You know, who cares? You know, that wasn't really important, was it? You know, and it wasn't, right? But, you know, when you're in it, it just seems like so urgent, right? Everything seems so pressing, and you get a little perspective and you realize, well, that wasn't that, who cares? You know, I'll call him when I get back, right? You know, I'll let him, when I get back, I'll deal with it, right? You know, it's necessary to get away in psychologically, and you just naturally do. You know, you naturally do. And by around the end of day two, it really, these details are now in their proper place. You realize this is not that important, you know. You go through a change of consciousness as well, right? I mean, the first day you're thinking about, you're worried, and so on. And then, you know, as you move into the Sesshin, it's often the case that those concerns seem less pressing. And then, things that might really be important to you, because you enter a state of more empty, a calm centeredness, you know, or towards the end of day two. And then sometimes things that are really of concern come out, right? Sometimes people busy themselves with stuff, but you know, that's not the real issue. You know, it's like that's just papering over something that's bothering them really, you know. When I was doing my dissertation for my PhD, I would wake up at night and I would just be absolutely like tossing in my bed trying to figure out, how am I going to finish this chapter? I don't know what to say. I don't know where I'm going. And my dissertation director was kind of checked out. He had a very hands-off approach, so I couldn't go to talk with him. And you know, during this period, I became obsessively angry at Ronald Reagan, who deserves, you know, to be deserves it. You know? But it was like, you know, it was like unhealthy. It was like, what, Reagan again? You know, and I'd be furious, and I'd read in the paper, you know, that Reagan. You know, I think a lot of it was sort of masking what was really bothering me, which was my self-doubt and so on. So, you know, people do this, they busy themselves, and then, you know, by day three of Sesshin, they begin to realize, oh, I feel very lonely in my life, you know, or, you know, I really don't like my job, you know, I'm really, really not happy in my work. That takes a lot of perspective. You have to really you have to detach from everything in order to have that encounter, you know, with what's really bothering you. So this idea that meditation retreats, or as they're so called, Zen, Sesshin, is about going to a peaceful place and being calm and so on, is absolutely true to a point, right? And if you tell people you're going to I used to keep it a secret from people at work what I did, and that only lasted for a couple of years, and now everybody in my office knows, you know, who I am and what I do, and they don't even bother to cover for me anymore. The deans know, So I used to instruct them, say, I'm at an academic conference, right? And now they just go, he's at Sesshin, and they go, okay, I'll call him when he's back, you know. So, and I don't have a phone, so they can't reach me. So it's necessary to get away. But on the other hand, right, you know, it's also the case that when you enter that serene, you know, day two or day three of Sesshin can be a beautiful place to be. And please enjoy it. I'm not criticizing. You know, you get into day two or three of Sesshin and you get up in the morning and you go outside and you see, you know, they've really improved the grounds here, you know. Used to just be a barren field, and they've planted all this stuff, and there's gardens around the building now, and there's clematises going up the pillars, and it's just like a little garden paradise, right? And you know, it's a beautiful day. It's not too cold, not too hot, you know, and you can be in sort of this blissful sort of heaven state, you know, for a day or two. And then what you might find is somewhere along the line, you know, like around day three or four of your Sesshin, all of a sudden it's like, oh no, here it all comes again, right? I thought this was about getting away from all of that and being in a serene place, but, you know, sometimes what happens later in the Sesshin is some of this stuff starts bubbling up again, and you might feel like, what's gone wrong? You know, where have I gone wrong? I shouldn't be bothered by this stuff now. I'm in, you know, Buddha paradise. But actually, that's not really what, you know, that would be escapism, wouldn't it? You know, I often say, if, you know, people sell zazen and meditation in general are marketed in a way that's very unhealthy, right? So, you know, I talked yesterday about how all the Tibetan teachers always are photographed laughing and having a great time. And people do associate Zen and meditation in general and Buddhism with happiness, and happiness is good, right? It's very important. But on the other hand, you know, in your Sesshin, around this time, it may happen that problems surface, right? And those are your real problems sometimes, right? Not always, but, you know, the problem of, you know, the problem at work, you know, probably can wait a week. And, you know, there's probably something deeper going on that's coming out at this stage, right? And in a way, your true nature, your big mind is asking you to deal with this. And so this is not a failure on your part to be adequately meditating. It's not like you've lost your concentration and now you're slipping back. There's really no such thing as slipping back if you practice. So whatever is happening is important and needs to be paid attention to. So around this time, what can happen is stuff starts coming up that we haven't necessarily dealt with. And if that doesn't happen, you know, koans are designed to help that happen. So in Zen practice, you know, sometimes, you know, koans are wonderful, wonderful devices because they allow us to be truthful to ourselves in a way we might not want to be, see. So, you know, if you, it's very hard for people to be truthful about themselves because we want to tell the best story we can about ourselves. And when we begin to put that story at risk, it's very difficult to go forward, right? It's like, you know, so, on a koan basically doesn't seem to be about you at all, right? It's really about you know, medicine and being sick, you know, that's, you know, Or it's about, if you have a staff, I will give you one. If you have, it's about a staff, or somebody's staff turns into a dragon, or somebody's on a mountaintop. You know, it doesn't seem to have anything to do with you. So it's a little bit sneaky, right? It's sort of saying, don't worry about this. You know, it has nothing to do with you. It's ancient China, you know, the mystical East, you know. And so you start working with it though, and it can start cracking you open. And koans rather have different. Not all koans work the same way. You know, some koans are more about your personal life, and some koans are more about the way you perceive things. Those two things are obviously connected, though, right? So, you know, if you're feeling lonely in your life, you know, that is not just a personal situation. It probably has something to do with very deep-seated patterns of experiencing the moment, experiencing other people, and so on. You know, there's a koan that says, you know, Seize is utterly destitute. There's a koan that Seize is utterly destitute, right? You know, and I imagine most of us have felt utterly destitute at certain points, but the koan isn't you feel utterly destitute, it's Seize. So it's, oh, okay, well, it's not me, right? But you begin to engage with the koan and you might begin to feel, oh, you know, I've been there. In fact, maybe you're there right now. I'm feeling utterly destitute, right? So the koan, it helps us to sort of crack open the shell of defensiveness and begin to get at things in ourselves that we never don't allow ourselves to recognize and to transform ourselves. So, this is really magical and wonderful. It's very important to deal with your stuff. You know, not all koans have a personal and existential dimension. You know, so not all koans are about your relationship with your brother or about, you know, your whatever. Some koans are a little bit more like science. You know, they're how do you perceive this at this moment? What happens there's a very famous koan where somebody just holds up a staff and says, what is this? You know, is an object here all the time? Is it here intermittently? How is it here? You know, so there are koans like that too. But they're all sort of getting at these deeply embedded mental habits that we can't change directly by choice. You know, you have to crack yourself open and enter deep samadhi, deep mushin, and then work your way through to a solution. And this process of working through is very complicated. It's like reorienting yourself. So, you know, when you begin to work with a koan, at first you think, you know, oh, this is a funny puzzle. And then you begin to realize, you begin to get caught in the contradiction. And then you begin to realize that this is not just an abstract contradiction, it's a contradiction in you. And then the koan takes a kind of urgency, and there's a lot of flailing around, right? Or can be. And what has to happen is, you really have to go through a shift of perspective that just happens after a while. You know, if you keep going into mu, you keep wiping away and wiping away and wiping away, you finally see it. You finally see things in a new way. Yesterday I was talking about looking at a mandala, and it's like you look at the details and it just looks like chaos. There's a guy over here dying, and there's a person over here throwing rocks at somebody, and there's a hermit on a mountaintop meditating. And then you step back and it all fits together into this patterned symmetry, right? And you know, the koan works a little differently. You keep wiping away, mu shin wipes away the mental image you form of something. So, or the idea you form, and it wipes it away, and then you form a new one, and it wipes it away, and you form a new one, and it wipes it away, and you form a new one. Finally, you know, there's like a shift of perspective. And, you know, it's generally the case that you're not going to be aware of it fully when you come into the Dokusan room at first. So for a long time in your Zen practice, you'll come in and you might not know why you have gotten the right answer, you know. Some people have said to me, I have no idea why that was the right answer. Don't worry, you know, don't worry. At any rate, you know, getting stuck, being caught, nobody likes that. Nobody likes dealing with things that are difficult and painful in everyday life or on the cushion. But actually, it would be impossible to wake up without those things, you know. So, you know, one of the words I really dislike in describing Zen is Buddhism is transcendent. I don't know if you've heard that word, transcendent. So lots of spiritual and religious people love the word transcendent. See, so it's like the human being is like a lotus that's down in the filthy muck and mud, and it rises out of the muck and the mud to the sun, through the pure water and up to the sun. And it leaves behind the muck and the mud. See, that's a one way of looking at things. But, you know, actually, that's a, I think, a very false view. You know, there's no way for you to flower, to become awake, without getting down there in the muck and the mud. It is Buddha nature too, right? So, you know, nobody likes being stuck. Nobody likes being out on a limb. Nobody likes being left hanging. You know, left hanging. What am I going to do? You know, there's actually a koan where there's a guy who's hanging by his teeth over a chasm. And he has to speak. He has to make a choice. Somebody comes up and says, "Help, I need your help. Say something that will help me, or I'm going to, you know, commit suicide or something." But if the guy says something, he's going to fall into the chasm. So, you know, he's gripping this tree limb by his teeth. I mean, it's a koan, right? It's like a dream. So it's a dream-like koan. He's hanging by his teeth. If he opens his mouth, he falls into the chasm. If he doesn't help this person, he fails as a human being, right? So you know, nobody likes hanging like that. But that koan is about that very thing, right? So it's absolutely, you know, nobody likes these things. But if you embrace these challenges as opportunities to wake up, it can really turn things around. You know, if you think about everything is my rice, everything is my rice, everything is food for me to cultivate my awakening, cultivate my mind. You know, I've told this story before, but it's such a wonderful story. There was a woman named, she's dead now, but her name was Jiyu Kennett, her Dharma name was Jiyu. She was the first, as far as I know, she was the first ordained Anglican woman, ordained Anglican woman priest in Great Britain. And she was a very religious person, very brilliant woman. She went to the top schools. She wanted to become a priest, and they said, "You can't become a priest in the Episcopal Church. You're a woman." And she made her case, she fought it, you know, and she finally got ordained. And then, you know, she had this incredible curious mind. And, you know, she actually started reading all these books on Buddhism and Zen. And it just became this burning passion for her. And she decided to chuck it all and go to Japan and study Zen in a monastery. Now, that's extraordinary in itself. I mean, she fought so hard to become an Episcopal priest, and then she sort of had a religious crisis and started looking to Buddhism and walked away from all of that, which most people would never do. They'd be sort of closet Buddhists, you know, they'd be Episcopal priests and they'd take out their Buddhist books on the weekend and, you know, keep them on the shelf somewhere, you know, and think about Tibet and so on. But, you know, she just jumped into this, right? And she went to Japan and there was a very progressive Roshi, a very progressive teacher whose name escapes me right now, but he said, yes, you can study with me. But he was progressive. But, you know, the Japanese have many good traits, but they are, A, extremely racist, and B, they are extremely sexist. Not all Japanese are racist. It's definitely so that there are many wonderful Japanese, and there are probably a few men in Japan who aren't sexist. So basically, she went there and encountered both of those prejudices, right? She was in this monastery, and first of all, they resented the fact that she was a, you know, Caucasian in this setting. And they really resented the fact that she was a woman. It was just like, this was too much to bear. So everybody started to basically make life hell for her, right? We'll show the Roshi that this woman should not be here. She's not up to the challenge, right? This is a typical situation for women when they're trying to break in anywhere. But this was a special case, right? And so, you know, these monks would lie to her or misdirect her. You know, if the job was to rake the yard, a monk would say, here, do it like this. And then she would do it, and then a more senior monk would come by and say, that's not how we do it, and scold her, right? So the other monk had set her up for failure. And, you know, people would say to her, don't worry, I'll wake you up. You know, you can be in the Zendo by 5, I'll wake you up. And then they wouldn't wake her up. So then, you know, she wakes up and, oh my God, they're chanting the sutras. And she races in and she's, you know, her robe isn't on straight and she scrambles. And then everybody just nods their head like, of course, you know. So this went on and on. And, you know, she got so discouraged. And she went to the Roshi and she said, you know, everybody's against me, you know, every hand is against me here. And, you know, it's disgraceful that monks who are supposed to be cultivating compassion would behave this way, but humans, you know, monks are just humans, you know, and I've known quite a few monks who are jerks, you know, really. But, you know, basically the Roshi, fortunately, was not, and he said, listen, he said, just everything is helping you wake up. Everything is helping you wake up. Everything is helping you wake up. And, you know, and then that she said that transformed her experience. You know, it's like everything becomes an opportunity to deepen your encounter with true nature. And, you know, we don't always succeed. We sometimes, you know, things get the better of us. We get knocked down and we just get back up again. You know, you get knocked down and you get back up. You know, we make mistakes. We make misjudgments. We get our, you know, my true nature has, listening to my true nature has never failed me. But sometimes my true nature has given me instructions that seem very difficult to carry out. And at the time, I might be thinking, why am I doing this, right? Later, I'm happy I did it. But you know, sometimes we misread the voice of our true nature. And later we realize, oh, I didn't really listen, you know. So we all make mistakes. We all fall down. But you know, if you just embrace everything as an opportunity to wake up, for her it worked like magic. And it is true from the Buddhist standpoint. It is true. You know, this is not we're not fallen creatures in a fallen world. Everything that's happening is an opportunity to wake up. You know, from the Buddhist viewpoint, all human beings are on the path to enlightenment. And everything that happens to them is an opportunity, like a gift, to wake up. And that can include things like, you know, that can include things like anxiety disorders. It can include things like, coming from an abusive family. It can include things like having, diabetes, you know. Everything is helping you wake up. Everything is help. That's so important. And it certainly has helped me. You know, I've definitely been helped by following that principle. And I'm quite convinced it's true. So often in my life, things that at first seemed like, just seemed like impossible obstacles, turned out to be things that greatly enriched my life and my practice. So you know, it's very necessary to have sickness and medicine both. You know, those two things are essential for waking up. And you know, just remember, you know, it's not rising up out of the mud. You know, the lotus isn't rising up out of the mud. You know, the world is everything is our lotus. Everything is our mud, you know. And you can't have the lotus without the mud. And mud is Buddha nature too. Umon said to his disciples, "Medicine and sickness cure each other. All this earth is medicine. Everything is helping me wake up." Where do you find yourself? Secho's verse, "All the earth is medicine, ancient and modern. Men make a great mistake. Shut the gate, do not build the cart. The universe, is that by shutting the gate and not building the cart, by not taking a risk, right? The universe is the highway, vast and wide. Mistaken, all is mistaken." We all make mistakes, but even our mistakes are helping us wake up. "Though their noses are stuck up to heaven, they will all be pierced for a rope." You know, it's like a bull's nose is pierced. So it's like, you know, we're all in this together, you know. Sometimes it just seems like chaos, but everything, you know, everything is helping us wake up. So please keep that in mind.